So what does those of you who are involved in marriage and family therapy, what does AAMFT say on these issues that we're considering regarding work with same-sex folks, same-sex attracted folks? Well, these are easy to find. These are called position on couples and families, not restricted to members. From time to time, AAMFT receives questions about a practice known as reparative or conversion therapy, which is aimed at changing a person's sexual orientation. As stated in previous policy, association does not consider homosexuality a disorder. You saw that in the APA handout as well. As such, we see no basis for such therapy. AAMFT expects its members to practice based on the best research and clinical evidence available. For a review of research on these therapies, please see, and that they have actually, it's online, it's a click here, it takes you to this article, systematic review of research based on sexual reorientation therapies. And that article, which I've looked at in detail, and the abstract ends with this sentence in parentheses and italics there. Abstract conclusion: results indicate the literature base is full of omissions which threaten the validity of interpreting available data, which I think is an honest report from that particular document. Nevertheless, you will have that statement actually referred to on the website of AAMFT, and you will have, as we've seen on the APA site, a statement that it says, these therapies are sometimes ineffective and sometimes harmful, but at other places, the professional organizations make a much stronger stance, make much stronger statements, as you'll notice in some of these handouts. Something that let's go ahead and read some more of this. The statement on non-pathologizing sexual orientation. The AAMFT takes a position that same-sex orientation is not a mental disorder. Therefore, we do not believe that it requires treatment. The development of the field of marriage and family therapy has included a tradition and perspective that eschewed the medical model historically. Though pathology or diagnosis was not been a part of our field, but it is now. Basically. At the same time, we have had a history stating that discrimination based on sexual orientation and other personal characteristics, such as gender, physical ability, religion, creed, ethnicity, etc., is unethical. Now, future considerations. We do not recognize that treatment of those clients who present feeling confused or we do recognize that treatment of those clients who present feeling confused about or wanting to change their sexual orientation should be undertaken with great care, knowledge, and openness. Therefore, it is our intent as an association to provide information to our members through clinical care guidelines and other methods. There's what I want you to notice here from this handout and from these statements on AAMFT is that in this rapidly evolving culture with issues like sexual orientation, which is so highly emotionally charged, there's some equivocating in our professional organizations. As I was proposing earlier, their guidelines don't quite keep up with the current state of the research or the landscape of marriage itself. You have here in this piece of the handout, you have AAMFT saying we don't discriminate and don't want to discriminate. You have AAMFT saying that therapies to help persons with reorientation is basically ineffective and harmful, and yet you do have support for client autonomy at the same time, and for non-discrimination against religious persons who might not see who don't see sexual orientation perhaps the same way as their culture. So It's a fuzzy and somewhat of a fine line. I want to talk to you about, on the next page, amicus brief regarding Proposition 8. As you know, in 2008, California voters voted to state that marriage will only be between a man and a woman in their state. And this was debated in the courts and finally the Supreme Court. And amicus brief, amicus of course meaning friend, a friend of the court, the American Psychological Association, American Psychiatric Association, and AAMFT put together this, an amicus brief, and sent this to the courts in favor of the legality of gay rights, which, of course, won the day. But I want you to note some of this language. Research and the clinical experience of amicus members also indicate that once established, sexual orientation is resistant to change. Nonetheless, several groups and individuals have offered clinical interventions, sometimes called conversion or reparative therapies, that purport to change sexual orientation from homosexual to heterosexual. No scientifically adequate research has shown that such interventions are effective or safe. Indeed, research suggests the opposite. The American Psychological Association task force conducting a systematic review of the peer-reviewed journal literature on sexual orientation change efforts concluded that efforts to change sexual orientation are unlikely to be successful and indeed can be harmful. Now, there's different language right there in the same paragraph in this legal document. No scientifically adequate research has shown that such interventions, earlier in the paragraph, are effective or safe. Indeed, research suggests the opposite, a stronger statement than actually the APA initially put out from their task force documentation. Next paragraph, amici believe that the potential benefits of marriage for gay men and lesbians is the same. Believe that the potential benefits of marriage for gay men and lesbians, I think it should be, is the same, or in same-sex couples, excuse me, are similar to those that have been documented for heterosexuals. Married men and women generally experience better physical and mental health than their unmarried counterparts. These health benefits do not appear to result simply from being in an intimate relationship, because most of the studies have found that married individuals generally manifest greater well-being. This is a real interesting portion of this legal document, the amicus brief, where the mental health organizations that are sending this to the Supreme Court are making a strong case for marriage. What they're saying is marriage is stabilizing and healthy for persons, and we don't want that benefit to be denied persons who are of the same sex. I thought it was kind of an interesting type of argument in our culture that where cohabitation has been normalized so strongly over the years. Is that making sense? Is that that's kind of an interesting piece there? It's healthy. Marriage is good. Therefore, we want same-sex persons to have that as well. Last paragraph, research has shown that adjustment, development, psychological well-being of children is unrelated to parental sexual orientation as well. That was another piece of the argument. And this is there's research there. I have not spent the time to go look carefully at that research. One last thing about AAMFT that I'd like you to notice, and that is AAMFTE, that's the accrediting arm or body that's associated with AAMFT. In the new accreditation standards, version 12, they often use the term, instead of marriage and family therapist, couple or marriage and family therapy professional to designate MFTs. And there was a significant reaction to that from various persons in the organization. So the new standards for accreditation sometimes use marriage and family therapist, sometimes use couple or marriage and family therapist, and in efforts, I think, to accommodate the same-sex unions, at least partially, that are popular, more popular in our country than ever before. And they make this statement then also. Thus, the standards have a broader focus previously on the education of marriage and family therapy professionals rather than solely therapists. We recognize the scope that of practicing, applying relational, systemic, or other postmodern perspectives involves individual, couple, marital, and family. However, the commission recognizes that the name of our profession is and will continue to be marriage and family therapy, state licensure laws, credential MFTs, and expects students to graduate from MFT programs, and our parent organization remains the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. So there, the pushback on that was, if we're going to start naming ourselves differently, what about all the licensure laws? What about the insurance laws? So that was a great concern, and that's something that's been going on in our organization. All right, let's pick up again with our next phase. Where is this, all of this heading, all of these papers, all these handouts? Where are we going with all of this, you may be wondering. I have a destination in mind. Bear with me in the vehicle as we move along. I believe we'll get to that destination and find some interesting things. So you have the in our secularized society, you have an increasing endorsement from mental health organizations trying to help mental health professionals be trained to be lesbian and gay affirmative. And you have statements about the harmfulness of reparation. And then you have some authors like Gagnon talking from a theological basis. But then I want you to consider for us to look at some of the Yarhouse definitions, not only definitions, but Yarhouse research and outcomes of their work. They are evangelical Christians, and I believe they're outstanding researchers of great integrity as well. So if you will find a handout that says on reorientation therapy, let's take a look. We're going to look at Yarhouse here and a little bit of APA. Reorientation therapy has as its goal change of sexual orientation from homosexual to heterosexual. Reparative therapy is a specific form of reorientation therapy that places emphasis on repairing a normal drive that the adherent believes has been misdirected and taken the form of homosexuality in the life of the individual with a homosexual orientation. So someone who adheres to reparative therapy, there's an underlying belief system the normal heterosexual attraction is present but misdirected. Now, at this point, it's probably useful to say that in June of 2013, you may be aware that the leading organization to assist men and women to move out of a gay lifestyle, that organization called Exodus International, closed their doors, and the then president of that organization made a public and very public, as the media picked it up, announcement apologizing to the gay community for hostility against it, and for falsely promising the participants in Exodus more than they were in fact finding that they could deliver. They also apologized for the number of persons who were leaders in Exodus who had gone back into homosexual relationships, which was a part of the realization that their own effectiveness wasn't as they were hoping, as they were advertising, and they had a strong spiritual zeal. Basically, you can change. God can give you the strength to not only stay away from what the Bible seems to say is wrong behavior, but you can change. You can become heterosexual. Let's look at APA on treatment. Psychologists strive to understand the effects of stigma. We already looked at that. We looked at those in another handout. Item three, we believe that these feelings, behaviors are normal variants. Now let's look at this paragraph beginning with the words existing data from Yarhouse in his work. This is from his most recent publication in 2014, which is an excellent book. I highly recommend. Very well done and covering more than same-sex issues. The existing data on efficacy of change methods suggests that most homosexuals do not find a cure in reorientation programs. Many struggle all their lives with homosexual inclinations, self-hatred, and guilt. Even in cases of reorientation or behavior modification, many individuals are still tempted by lustful thoughts or homoerotic urges. To present treatment less realistically or to assume overly optimistic projections of outcome of current treatment procedures is to engage in ethically questionable practice. Based on this very strong evangelical Christian, excellent researcher, based on his knowledge of the field, he is saying, be cautious. If you have clients who come to you and they say that their presenting problem has to do with urges toward the same sex, sexual urges toward the same sex, disclosure statements and informed consent should indicate something like this, that this is very difficult change, seldom realized in that sense. Does that mean that Yarhouse and persons like him who study in this field and work in this field, does that mean that they don't try to help people who come with that presenting problem? No, they, as a matter of fact, do. But I think they're very ethical about what the realistic expectations can be, and I would like to follow their lead. Next paragraph, is reorientation therapy harmful? The basis for the charge of harm has been largely anecdotal, derived from the growing phenomenon of ex-gays, or those who at one time indicated that they were in a change program of some kind, were attempting to become ex-gay, but felt that they did not experience success in that change effort. I allowed the citation to be there. Again, this is, I believe I'm bringing you a very solid piece of research material. And so you have our secular field saying this is harmful, and you have, I believe, the research saying it can be harmful, as all therapy can be harmful to clients. Let's look at the last paragraph, report on the APA Task Force and appropriate therapeutic responses to sexual orientation. Task Force conducted a systematic review of peer-reviewed journal literature on sexual orientation change efforts and concluded that efforts to change sexual orientation are unlikely to be successful and involve some risk of harm. That actually is the statement of the APA that I think it's significantly inflated. And other pieces of literature from our field. To turn that page over, I won't go through this entire longitudinal study with you by any means, but this 2007 book is a detailed account of Stan Jones and Yarhouse research, actually, in the Exodus movement. And you can see down at the second bulleted section, the first set of bullets actually are, it's Yarhouse talking about another very successful, useful study in the field. And then he compares their study as well. You can see some of the stats above of the total N of 98. It was a longitudinal study, three measures over a period of time. And their conclusion was 38% of the subjects did consider themselves to have successfully changed. 49% to have some change, and 33% report no change or return to homosexuality. I think you have some realistic figures there. I have two more things to do with you, and I think that we're in good shape regarding time. Let me, yes. Now, that blank that I left blank for you way back on page one, what do I think we need to know? What do I think needs to inform us in this field, in both as persons who have a stance and a position regarding same-sex attraction and marriage and treatment, and also as persons who will be working with clients who likely will all work with clients at some point, and I certainly have over my history of seeing clients, who have what they would describe as unwanted same-sex attraction. What else should inform us? Well, I wanted you to see what our field was saying, and we've done that at the risk of boredom. I wanted you to see what I consider the best research in the field says, and I think that's your house and Jones and Tan. But I want to take you to a slightly different place and say that I believe we should be informed by God's word and good hermeneutics, and I think we should be informed by our field. It has wisdom for us and cautions for us, and we should be informed by the research. But regarding our positions and our personal work, I think we should also be informed by items 4C, accurate knowledge of clients. Well, that sounds simple. Accurate knowledge of clients. I mean, obviously, a couple of very simple examples. Can I treat a minor? I need to make an ethical decision about whether this 15-year-old woman coming to my office can be treated by me. I need not only the ethical knowledge from my field. I need some knowledge of the client. For instance, I can't engage her in ongoing treatment if she's a minor. But if I have the knowledge of her individually that she's had a child, then she has the right to consent to treatment like any other adult. And if I don't know that, I will be unethical in how I handle just the approach. And think of the many, many examples. How do I treat this? Let's say a parent brings in and a 15 or 14-year-old teenage boy is willing to come in for therapy as well, and he's reporting depression and desires of self-harm. See, it's not just knowledge of my field and knowledge of treatment. I need to know about him and their family, don't I, to make a decision as to whether, do I treat him individually? Because that's what the parents have said. Or do I treat this systemically? Is this a reflection of the system? Is this a system-maintaining behavior that systems therapy is so famous for detecting and helping? So I need, obviously, knowledge of the client but to make ethical decisions. But as I realize, as I think about homosexuality, I believe I need knowledge of the persons to help me be informed, or to inform my position and my individualized reaction with clients. And let me elaborate. I was telling you before about Susan, this woman that I met. And as I got to know Susan better, and we shared vulnerable material with each other, we became friends. Susan and I believe, are friends. And as I said, we've had a couple of telephone conversations, awkward, more awkward for me than her of late, which Interestingly enough, we both said, and I asked her, okay, Susan, after talking about your homosexual lifestyle and your beliefs about the Bible and about sexuality, and you're hearing my beliefs, do you think we are now more hostile toward each other or that our relationship has been enhanced? Do you think we're more estranged? And she said, oh, unequivocally, undoubtedly, our relationship is deeper, yet we've been talking about profound differences. Well, so I wrote a little paper that I'd like to, a little document. It's called The Benefits of Getting to Know Susan. Upon getting to know Susan, I did not change my positions. Well, this is a very personal statement for me. But, one, the LGBT horde did not seem so personally hostile toward me and my loved ones. In fact, maybe horde was not the correct referent. I experienced a lessening of siege mentality. Less polarization. Remember, I didn't change my position. I pondered, perhaps I have some false impressions gained from sensational media stories of militant protesters or even gained from well-meaning Christian programming, like Focus on the Family. I believe even the slightest reduction in false impression to be a good thing. But by the way, let me say here, I sent these to Susan and we talked about them. And she's at our first conversation, our second conversation, she said, you know, I've been thinking a lot about what you said about siege mentality. And she said, that sounds terrible to me. That sounds tragic. I have a lot of sadness and compassion for that, to think that you and folks like you, evangelical Christians, are being asked to deny your faith in order to practice psychology or therapy, in a sense. And the statistics are changing in terms of the numbers of people that don't agree with you, and you're becoming more the marginalized group that I've been in for such a long time. She's moved with compassion. Number two, I'm ashamed to say that I was struck by how the image of God shone so brightly in Susan. Her knowledge of my conservative Christianity did not seem to render her hostile or unbecoming in some way. She was gentle and kind. She seemed a good deal more generous and hospitable than I. She seemed humble and vulnerable. She did not seem weak, but I found myself wanting to make sure that persons like me, evangelical Christians, did not hurt her through misunderstanding, disparaging rejection. I wanted her to be treated well, and I wanted this in a much more passionate, real way than I wanted it previously for a nameless, faceless LGBT agglomerate. Knowing Susan, I didn't know that kind of compassion for the gay community, let alone any individual persons. Number three, I had a great increase in my desire for Susan to know the Savior. By the way, when Susan read this, she said, oh, Bill, thank you. Not because I could now clearly see that she was a sinful, miserable homosexual. I was a little bit worried about her reading that portion. But she chuckled like you did. But because I came to know her and I came to love her, I experienced her love for me and began to feel the kind of caring that you can only have for someone whom you actually know. I experienced a growing desire to learn about gayness from Susan. How did her gayness come about? Did it seem to evolve? Was it reaction to a negative male relationships? Did it seem to be always there dormant? If Beth passed away, could she imagine her sexual orientation changing to heterosexual? These are just some things that went around my head. Susan shared some vulnerable disclosures with me. In so doing, she seemed an honest, open person. I had the impression that she would truthfully and non-reactively answer my inquiries. Reading good research is invaluable, but something about rounding this out with a real person seems useful and necessary. After all, therapy and ethics is about persons. Somehow moving to a knowledge of Susan as opposed to this nameless, faceless horde That seems, that seemed so hostile toward my stance. It's been an interesting change. I began to have a greater understanding of the issue, that is to say, gayness and biblical anthropology. For example, she had been in a loving, stable relationship with Beth for 25 years. Now it's 30. Simply proclaiming that her heterosexuality is right, excuse me, simply proclaiming that heterosexuality is right, therefore you should leave that relationship, seemed, well, just too simple. When I say a greater understanding of the issue was realized by getting to know Susan, I mean a greater understanding of the complexities of the issue began to emerge. This is not to say good answers to these complex questions do not exist, but I began to re-realize the profundity of Proverbs 18:13, namely, answering before listening is folly and shameful. Bad answers are indeed possible, and they seem to be inversely related to listening and learning. Good answers take more work. This is a tough field. We'll be considering these things and being challenged by these things as therapists more and more, as I attempted to show early on by the news clippings. So what I'd like you to do now is right where you're sitting, I would like you to become a little group of like about four people. And I have some vignettes for you, and I want you to decide what you can decide on these vignettes. I think we don't have enough copies for quite every person. This is my technological concern. Later on, when Cynthia was talking, like, where are those things? And she made some new ones for me. So here's some vignettes, and I'll have to explain them in a moment because they're a little bizarre. I'm going to give some packs out to every other table. And pass those around, please. Now, in a sense, I had to take you through some, you know what, that's too many I gave you there. We have a whole bunch of, we have a horde in the back there that, so pass those around if you would. And then let me tell you what I'd like you to do with them. Excellent. Extras? Yeah. Okay, let me explain how this works. Actually, all the things I've said to you up to now, anyone need an extra? Just send them back and they'll land somewhere good. All these things I've said to you really were so I could get to the place that I could say that an individual relationship has made a difference for me. An individual relationship has made a difference in my... not in my position, but in my attitude about my position. And it's made a difference in a personal ethic, which, as I said, therapy and ethics is personal. So here's what I'd like you to do. Among your little, I'd like you to work as a group, please, unless the people near you are just so bizarre that it would be uncomfortable. But put yourself in a little group, and you have to decide. There's some things you can decide, and there's some things you can't decide on this. You have some choice, but not total choice. You are an LMFT or an LPC in a state. Here's the vignette. That legalized, you need to pretend here because you're in Mississippi, that legalized gay marriage 3 years ago. And you work in a, and you, here's why you can decide. It's a private practice. Is it a drug and alcohol IOP, like Cynthia talked about? Is it an inpatient child and adolescent treatment facility, like Terry talked about? Oh, it all comes together now. So you work in one of those. And this is what happens. A lesbian couple in their early 50s, together for 25 years, married for 2 years, come to you together for therapy with the presenting problem as follows. And then here's where you get choice again. And your choice corresponds to the A, B, C, or above, right? One of the couple members is going through cancer treatment, and grief issues abound for both. That's private practice. If you're in a drug and alcohol IOP, an intensive outpatient program, then these people have come needing treatment for substance dependency disorder and the codependency that would go with it for any spouse of any gender or attraction level. Or if you're in a CARES-like facility that Terry talked about, you have a 13-year-old girl with depressive symptoms and she needs inpatient treatment, but Notice that you work in an inpatient child and adolescent treatment facilities, as per C above, which involves a great deal of family systems work. So there's a 13-year-old, she's depressed, she has two parents who are lesbian, and you want family to be involved. How is that for you? What kind of decisions would you make? Now, these are pretend, of course, that's what a vignette is, right? These are pretend. However, I really believe that the likelihood of this kind of scenario will increase exponentially for all of us as we practice. So what ethical issues arise for you? And specifically reference your respective ethical code, if you can. Someone there probably can look it up online, someone in your group. So take a few minutes and figure out. I'm going to ask for responses here in a moment. So please go to work. A little consensus. Yeah, you can be 5, you can be 3, you can be 2. Just get going. Okay, folks, can you wrap up in about 1 minute, please? All right, I'd like to have you back now. I of course, in a room this size, can't hear me. That is, in a room this size, there will be persons of different values, persuasions. I've realized in your little grouping, there's probably different values, persuasions as well. What ethical issues arose for your group? Somebody blurt something out. What kind of issues come up?
Can you overcome personal
lies? Would a referral, I'm going to imply that means, would a referral harm a client? So client welfare is an ethical issue coming up for you all. May I ask how you decided? I mean, not how you decided, but what was your decision? Did you have a consensus among you, or was it different? Yeah. How does that affect? Am I enhancing a relationship that and a sexual relationship, perhaps, that my values says is not God's design for life? Yes. And for Mike. We're at another ethical issue here. We're at informed consent. Mm-hmm. We want to let our clients know that our value, worldview and values is different from theirs. Or are they still comfortable?
Very respectfully, non-judgmentally, but just kind of like you do with Susan, kind of
being
very clear.
Mm-hmm. Any other, what are some other issues that came up for you, perhaps in other contexts? Yeah, if you would refer on the basis of values, Janelle is saying that she was told at a professional meeting that such a referral would set you up for a legally liable, a legal risk, and that you'd be potentially up for a lawsuit. And I think there are differences of opinion about that. Bill Lake down here says, if I'm strongly conflicted, I'm worried about client welfare, and maybe there's a practice issue. Practice issue there too. Yeah. Yes, Andrew. So you've actually moved away from scenarios. Now you're talking about someone coming in for some type of reorientation of therapy. And yeah, and Andrew has said that if someone comes in and it seems like they're qualifying for a diagnosis of an obsessive compulsive disorder around sexual issues, I don't think I have the expertise there, and I think that it would be ethical for me to refer on that basis. And Janelle said, "Yeah, and that's is it discrimination or not? Certainly, Hart. And in that sense, that's not discriminatory. Yeah, Hart."
Well,
No, absolutely. There are many devout Christians who will interpret homosexuality, same-sex attraction, differently. Yeah, and thus the that interesting book I mentioned, where there were, actually it's a debate book, two positions. Yeah. So, well, I'm glad to have you say that. Yeah. This, as you can probably tell, this isn't about I have it all figured out. Let me tell you how to proceed. This is about the rapidity of change in our culture around technology and around sexuality, and ethical guidelines really not keeping up with it. And so I'm here to encourage us all to continue looking and learning. That's a part of the learning. Well, what would be those other perspectives? Cynthia? Well, at the outset, as a corporate owner, of a treatment facility, and we're, time is gone here, but let me ask you, and you have a form, does that mean that you have responsibility, or you take responsibility, I would like to say, for asking persons to fill out that form? So you seek the information. So I was thinking, whose responsibility here is primary? Is it the person who's coming there for a job, or is it the employer? How do you respond to that? But I do notice that the employer back there in the corner initiates the conversation. And I think that's sort of like a meta level of informed consent. And you sponsor the retrieval of that information. And there are other issues, of course, that come up around that, with my job being in jeopardy, given this particular corporate environment, and so forth. But, well, thank you very much for your attention. Thank you very much for considering these difficult issues with me.